Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.
Know the past, shape the future. Welcome to the official podcast of the Air Force Historical Foundation. On this episode, we're continuing our conversation on the technological origins of the modern United States Air Force. Much of what the modern Air Force is doing today, they owe to the work of theoretical physicist, engineer, and aerospace visionary, Dr. Theodore von Karman. Today, we're talking to a man who knows his work better than anyone else, historian Dr. Michael Gorn. Here now is Dr. Dick Daso, the Executive Director of the Air Force Historical Foundation, with more on our guest.
Welcome, everybody, to the second in a series of podcasts that are going to discuss the origins of the technological base for the Air Force over time. One of my favorite dear old friends, Michael Gorn, PhD from USC, and has worked for the Air Force Office of History and out on the West Coast doing all kinds of great research on guys like Karman, now Hugh Dryden, written some X-Plane material. Just one of the greatest, kindest men you'd ever want to know. We're going to talk today about Theodore von Karman. And I met Mike while I was doing my initial research on Hap Arnold and his relationship with von Karman. And while I don't claim to know all there is to know about von Karman, everything I know about it, I learned from Mike. And I'm so grateful that he's agreed to be with us to talk about von Karman and his vital impact on the birth of the technological base of the United States Air Force. Take it away, Matt.
In the world of history, there's always a lot to rediscover. The Air Force knows that, too, so they employ a number of historians to preserve the history of their bases and work for future generations to rediscover. But for a new historian, someone right out of school, dreaming of rediscovering a lost temple or following some path filled with adventure, how does one discover the often quiet, maybe even mundane work of a base historian?
Accidentally, Matt. I got my first job in history as a historian at Air Force Systems Command. I didn't know anything about Air Force history. I had to teach myself and teach myself as quickly as possible. And I kept seeing the name Theodore von Karman. A Systems Command was, of course, a Research and Development and Acquisitions Command that's since been merged and has disappeared. But in those days, von Karman was up in pictures on the hallways and mentioned all the time, and I'd never heard of him. So after a year or two, when I had learned enough to know something, I started to inquire who he was and discovered there was no biography of him and that I might as well see if I could fill that in. So that was one of the best experiences of my career, and it turns out my first one doing von Karman.
And when did you write that biography on Theodore von Karman?
Let's see. I guess it would have been roughly from 1988, and it came out in 1992.
Yeah, so over 20 years after his death, and it's fascinating to me to think that someone who has given so much to so many people, that there wasn't already something. I mean, that had to be surprising for you.
Well, you've just made the argument for historians. It's incredible, and you learn this I learned it as a federal historian, that if there isn't somebody to record the past consciously and, you know, on a daily basis, the past simply disappears or it falls into folklore. And so giants like Von Karman, giant personalities too, you know, people we want to remember because they were so indelible, or Hugh Dryden for that matter, they disappear. And that's a historian friend of me. I think Dick probably knows this guy, Von Hardesty, said to me once, all history is the act of resurrection, and that's really what it is. And so I think that kind of answers the question.
Yeah. For those of you like me who have not really taken a deep dive into Theodor von Karman, the fact that so much of what he came up with is now come to fruition. I mean, talk about resurrection. Mm-hmm. We're seeing really this man's life work sort of come forward. And when Dick first started talking about this idea of New World Vistas, a project that you worked on, Dick, it all sort of became clear what you were trying to shape into this. What does it mean to you, Dick, just as we start off here?
Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting to understand about von Karman is his background in the academic community is one thing, but he had a technological grasp on initially on flows and things in three dimensions that it's very difficult for people to visualize. And he set a standard for thinking above where most people are capable of thinking. The thing that I learned about von Karman is he was a seed sower. He, when he was a professor in California, one of his things would be to gather his students all together and let them bounce ideas off of him. And he would finally get them steered towards a target, and then he'd let them go. He did that throughout his career. He did it with the Scientific Advisory Board, and then he did it further when he expanded his scientific reach in Europe after the war was over, but we can get to that later. He's remarkable in that he had a vision at a very high level, and he would surround himself with people that he trusted to grab the ball and run with it.
And is there a lot of truth, and I'm curious about this because it just sort of paints the picture of this guy, born back in the 1880s. I read somewhere that his father actually discouraged him because he was such a mathematical wizard. His father was sort of afraid that he might be ridiculed for this. And that's just so hard for me to believe, that in today's standard, a father or a mother would be thrilled that their son or daughter could do these types of calculations in his head. I'm just curious, did you run into that in your research, that there was some, hey, maybe you don't multiply, you know, all of these numbers together in public?
Yes, that's true. In his early teens, his father, Maurice von Karman, basically forbade him from science and mathematics, realizing that he was so gifted in those areas. And he wanted it to fill his mind with the humanities as well. And this is a very important, and I think it pertains to what Dick is saying about being a seed spreader, being comfortable with all kinds of people. He once said, I always assume the other person is exactly as intelligent as I am. So when he would check into he would often stay at the Cornell School of Hotel Management, and he would remember the names of the person at the front desk, people who waited tables, all that sort of thing. Yes, it's true that his father did steer him away. I don't think with the intention of keeping him away, just of rounding him. And it was a very important part of making him who he was. And I'll just add another thing, again, with the seed spreader idea. He was very comfortable and very practiced at working with military folks by the time he came to this country in 1930. The Aachen Aeronautical Institute in Germany that he ran was not a well-funded institution, and it was really back on its heels when he assumed the directorship before World War I. And he was able to make alliances not only with industrialists, but with military clients as well. So by the time he came to this country, by the time he met Hap Arnold, it was nothing new to him what the language was for military folks, what the objectives were, and it was easy for him, seamless.
Came over with the California Institute of Technology. Was there any political motivation behind him coming over here in 1930?
Yes.
Yeah, talk to us.
Excuse me. Yeah, he had experienced discrimination in rising through the academic ranks. And I don't think it was imagined. I think it was quite obvious. He was Jewish, and he was held back from the attainments he should have gotten, considering the discoveries that he made. So partly it was that, as with most immigration stories, it was push-pull. The push was that. The pull was Robert Andrews Millikan, the president of Caltech, who really wanted to import von Karman, if you want to put it that way, and put him at the head of a newly funded organization called the Guggenheim Aeronautical Fund for the Promotion of Aeronautics. And he finally did come over in 1930 with his sister and his mother, established a home on Marengo Avenue in Pasadena, which I was lucky enough to walk through many years ago. And that was the beginning of his American life, and he eventually became an American citizen.
It makes you wonder what would have happened had he stayed behind at Germany. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you really start to go down that path with Horton and with Lippisch and all of these brilliant minds that were working sort of along the same path. Do you think he ever had any encounters with those fellas?
I think he did. He remained, as well as seed spreading, international scientific cooperation was one of the most important pillars of his professional life. And he was in touch with scientists all over the world and organized them. Now, during the war, of course, not. But after the war, again, right after the war ended, he went right back to it. And that was a big part of his life.
So here's this brilliant man, but he's also kind and extremely personable, too. Von Karman is the complete package. When you study his work, one thing stands out. It's really easy to imagine that none of what the Air Force has today, thanks to von Karman's work, would exist had it not been for his relationship with General Hap Arnold. It's always amazing to me how truly exceptional people find each other at just the right moment. And thankfully, von Karman and Arnold did.
The relationship between von Karman and General Henry Hap Arnold was a close one and a friendly one. It began indirectly during World War I when, Robert Millikan was serving in the Army Signal Corps and met a young Army officer named Hap Arnold. And Millikan was impressed by him, by his depth of thought and vision for a young person. He must have mentioned him to von Karman, because when Arnold was posted to Marsh Field, I think in 1935, Millikan brought the two of them together. Arnold came to Caltech, and he came thereafter many times to see the wind tunnel that von Karman had built, to see the experiments, to make suggestions, to generally get the feel of cutting-edge aeronautics of that day. And the two became, I don't think it's right to say close friends, but became good friends and people who liked each other. It was very hard not to like either of them. But von Karman was very likable, very easygoing with people, very funny, a lot of body kind of humor. And so the friendship was forged then. Arnold left, I think, in 37, went back to Washington, D.C. And at that point, Arnold steered some federal work toward Caltech in jet-assisted takeoff, rocket canisters, rocket canisters that could be placed on aircraft to boost performance. And this was the beginning of the formal, the governmental relationship between the two men.
There was a great story about the group that was formed at Caltech, came to be known as the Suicide Club, because at one point they had a detonation in one of the Caltech laboratories, and they got kicked off of campus and moved out to the valley, I think the Arroyo Seco, to do rocket experiments. But they, after a period of time and developing these canisters, there's a classic image of Carmen writing a formula on the wing of the experimental, I think it was an Aircube aircraft.
That's right.
And his calculations were to see how many rockets would it take to get the Aircube to get off of the ground without any assistance from a propeller. I think the number came out to be like 8 on each wing. And so they loaded that onto the airplane, and they towed the Aircube with a deuce and a half and a rope out on the desert and lit all of the rockets off, and the airplane took off, and it flew, I don't know, maybe 5 feet into the air and then landed again. But there was the first rocket-propelled airplane, although it was assisted by a couple of horsepower. So that's the kind of stuff that Carmen was sort of on the leading edge of out of Caltech.
Just a quick note, that Aircube is still flying. The folks at the Fagan Fighters World War II Museum in Granite Falls, Minnesota, have restored it, minus the JATO bottles, where it's on display with their other award-winning aircraft restorations and exhibits.
In some ways, von Karman becomes the sort of the quintessential representative of American science and engineering. You know, you look at Germany, where a lot of it was theoretical, and then you look at how the Wright brothers did things with experiment and formula. There's a difference that the United States is one of those where it's great to have the theoretical stuff behind it, but there's the experimentation that is so important. And that's why the wind tunnel tests and like the development of the wing fillets to ease the airflow around certain parts. I think that was what he was doing on the DC-3 at the time. But there's a fundamental difference in science and engineering in America that there is in Europe. And he blends that successfully with his training in Europe and then his affiliation with not only the Hungarian military, but also later when he works with the army. And he's really a representative of that school of development of technology.
And he had just a few words symbolizes what Dick is talking about. He said, there's nothing more practical than a good theory. So you have practicality and you also have the underlying science. And he blended the two of them. And Dick is right. It's a uniquely American way of looking at engineering and science. You know, and it also underscores something about von Karman that goes all the way back to his early life, and that was that his father was a prominent man, a professor of education, and eventually many of his ideas were adopted by the Hungarian government and changed the Hungarian way of schooling so that it more imitated the German style. In any event, Maurice von Karman, his father, had a breakdown, a mental breakdown, was unable to work. And instead of Karman going to some of the great schools of Europe, like Cambridge or in German university, he had to stay in Budapest and went to a technical university there. But the value of it was that he was essentially taught as an undergraduate engineering. Then, as a graduate, he did go on to the great schools and got the theoretical life as well, the theoretical portion as well. So in something like the Aircube story, he acted both as an engineer and as a scientist. And this is something he completely integrated. Again, it's a seamless performance to deal with him. There's a famous picture of him standing on the wing of a DC-3 and doing some kind of calculation, a famous picture. And this was an important part of him.
A guy that wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty is what I'm hearing, which is an interesting
part. And he understood the engineering life because he was as much an engineer through his career as he was a scientist.
So remember the story about his father's insistence that he master the ability to communicate and not just become some kind of mathematical phenomenon? Well, it's von Karman's ability to relate and communicate with his peers and students that comes up time and time again, even when his own work begins to challenge his mentors.
He was an extraordinarily kind person. It isn't necessarily a trait that you expect in academic life. Here's an example. When he would, he had thousands of students in his career. If they were getting a D at the end of the semester, he would automatically raise it to a C. He had loads of former students who remained in his orbit as friends. He had parties at his home on Marengo Avenue where he had every kind of person you can imagine, Zsa Zsa Gabor and her Hungarian sisters were there. Catholic priest might have been there. Scientists, engineers, movie actors, all different kinds of people. It's the breadth of him as a person, and the at the center of it, this kindness, consideration for others. As I said, when he went to Cornell, remembering the names of people, and embodied in what he said, I always assume the other person is exactly as intelligent as I am. No typical ego that you see in those circles. That surprised me, and that appealed to me.
And if he did have an ego, where do you think it manifested?
Well, he knew he was exceptional in being able to understand these things. It manifested itself in a pretty intense relationship that he had with his mentor in Germany, Ludwig Prandtl. And Karman's extension of Prandtl's work challenged Prandtl. Prandtl took it that way anyway. And so it was a competition that went on for about 20 years. And there was a lot of throwing of elbows and that kind of stuff, not very gentlemanly. But that's a case where he would certainly stand for himself intellectually. Aside from his theoretical work in turbulence and that sort of thing, which remains today, I can hardly imagine an engineer in aeronautical engineering who doesn't know the name Theodor von Karman because of his work on turbulence. But the three words I would say would be, and I think Dick touched on this at the end of his first session, toward new horizons, the seminal look ahead, the seminal forecast that he did for Hap Arnold at the end of World War II. In it are the main lines of inquiry that go right through all of the long-range forecasts that the Air Force has done, up to New World Vistas, and I dare say right to the present. Guided missiles, radar, ballistic missiles, all the things that are still in the headlines today, that's the origin point for them, at least for American science and engineering. And I think that's the best way of remembering him. It's right up to the present. We're pursuing many of the same lines of research.
And when he was writing this stuff, what was the glimmer on the horizon that he would have held on to even dream this stuff up? Or was this just literally out of thin air from his imagination and his mind?
It comes, I think, out of his many, many friendships that he had with scientists and engineers around the world. Some of these ideas would have come from conversations at conferences, from papers that he chaired at the conferences. And some of it, of course, became obvious when he and the team of scientists that he brought together at the behest of General Arnold toured Europe twice, and some of Asia, and observed what World War II had brought to aeronautics. And this would have been manifestly clear then, the direction that things needed to go in if America would prevent another Pearl Harbor, which was very powerful in the American imagination, and I think still is, the idea of surprise attack. And this found its way into the toward New Horizons, which I might add was actually edited and largely written by Hugh Dryden, who was his deputy on this project, on the Toward New Horizons project.
Let's bring in Hugh Dryden just a bit, because you're working on a book about Hugh Dryden. How does all this fit together?
Well, Dryden and Carman were the two most unlikely friends in terms of personality. Carman was a bit flamboyant, outgoing, warm, talkative, and Dryden was had a kind of quiet charm, but he was quite self-contained, more of an observer than a speaker. But they shared in common a technical brilliance, and they came together in the 1930s, and they remain very close friends, not just colleagues, but close friends, all the way until von Karman died in 1963.
Carman's interests went far beyond just aeronautics. I mentioned last time that after the Tacoma Narrows Bridge blew down in the 1930s, he was the one who redesigned it, and it was rebuilt after they did a study of why it oscillated the way he did, and then he used his fluid dynamics experience to redesign the baffles on the bridge, which became a standard design feature on those kind of valley-driven bridges, and that was von Karman. Then his influence on the use of wind tunnels within the Army, I think, is one of the most important outcomes for the Air Force.
Yeah.
I think Mike can contribute to this one too, but one of the most interesting stories about Carman and Arnold was Arnold wanted, he asked von Carman at some point, what is the most important thing we need? And Carman told him, you need a wind tunnel. And so they started to create it. And I think it was at Langley that they started to build their own Army wind tunnel. About the same time, Arnold didn't totally get along with the government science advisor, Van Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And Van Bush told Carman, look, we're going to build this wind tunnel. Arnold told him, no, don't worry about it. We got it under control. And Bush asked him, well, who's building it for you? And he told him von Carman was. He had taken him away from the president's science advisor to do the work of aeronautical science in the Army Air Forces at that point in time. The important thing about that story is that Carman saw the benefit to not only to himself, but he was also benefiting Caltech. I think one of the things about him that is so interesting is the work he did for the Army and the Army Air Forces with Hap Arnold was partially to benefit Caltech. I mean, he was already pretty famous. He didn't mind being treated really well, like Hap Arnold would treat him, but it's not how Van Bush and government science would have treated von Karman.
Never hurts having the big guy on your side, and clearly von Karman had the support of General Arnold, and he knew it.
The lack of formality between Arnold and von Karman, I think, was a very important ingredient to the long relationship that that von Karman had with the Army Air Forces and then the Air Force. It was a personal, and it was a trusting relationship in that Arnold, von Karman went to Arnold and said, I'll do the scientific advisory work for you as long as I don't have a boss and as long as I don't have to give orders. And Arnold said, I'm your only boss. and don't worry about the orders. It's a relationship based on trust and friendship, and that's why it endured. And Dick is right. Von Karman was a famous person in his time. It's not as if he was a subordinate of Arnold in a general sense, but there were two exceptional people who decided they would get into the same yoke together and push ahead.
Theodor von Karman's work was recognized and honored, but perhaps his greatest achievement was being honored by President Kennedy with the first ever National Medal of Science.
Dr. Von Karman, you got some of your associates here?
I got all of
the
people.
Associates.
Yeah.
We couldn't hold this in the cabinet room because he has too many friends.
Man, Congressman. General LeMay, why don't you and some of these gentlemen come up here with us?
Yeah.
We get some of your other associates of the doctor who've come from, doctor came in from California.
Certainly. Yes, Dr. DeBridge.
Anybody here from California who came with the doctor or been working with him, if they would come forward?
Yeah.
Mr. Dr. Brown, why don't you come up here?
Okay. Mr. Dish from Elojet. Yeah. President of Elojet.
Now, where is Dr. Seitz?
We don't want to separate the scientists, but we get...
Dr. Seitz is responsible for the selection.
Yes, where is he?
He's coming up here.
I will adopt it.
Oh, I have some friends from Arizona, no?
Well, we all go over and say hello to them.
Yeah. You got too many friends.
Dr. Von Karman, it's a great pleasure for me to select you as the first recipient of the National Medal of Science. I know of no one else who more completely represents all of the areas with which this award is appropriately concerned, science, engineering, and education. This nation, and indeed the entire free world, holds you in the highest esteem and respect for your devoted service, for your scientific achievements, and for your warmly human gifts as a teacher and counselor. Your assistance to the United States Air Force and to the NATO Advisory Group for Aeronautical Research and Development have been outstanding. We also are deeply indebted to you for your continuing efforts in the promotion of international cooperation in science and in engineering. It is hard to visualize what the world would be like without aircraft and jet propulsion, or without the vision we have just entering the realm of reality of exploring space. I'm especially glad to present this first National Medal of Science to one of the pioneers who has helped make all of this new and exciting age possible. And the citation says, the National Medal of Science is awarded by the President of the United States to Theodor von Karman for his leadership in the science and engineering basic to aeronautics, for distinguished counsel to the armed services, and for promoting international cooperation in science and engineering.
So the ceremony had ended, and von Karman was walking off of the platform, and Kennedy came over to him, and he said, "You need help, Dr. von Karman." And he said, "Mr. President, one needs help going up, not going down." And at that point, he took his arm and helped him come down, and one of the pictures showed that.
Culturally, the ceremony at the White House in the Rose Garden with President Kennedy today maybe rings even more important than it was then. You had the first Catholic president of the United States presenting the first science medal to a Jew. And probably didn't think much about it then because the language of science overcame much of everything else. Today, it may mean more than it did back then. Well, there's so much more you can talk about with Karman. I'm kind of focused on his time with the United States and with the Army Air Forces and the Air Force. But what I do think is in 1994, when General Fogelman and Dr. Widnall decided to order the Scientific Advisory Board to complete another scientific forecast 50 years after the Karman study, it was brilliant. It was there are so many differences in how far technology had gone in the Air Force just by looking at the study. The original study had 33 scientists, and they produced 13 mini volumes of the study. The one in 94 and 95 had 450 scientists and produced 33 volume. It was a monstrous study. Yeah. What it tells me is that the progress of aviation science, technology, and engineering is so broad and great that you can't have 33 people who know it all. Now you have to have 400 people to cover all of the different aspects that might be important in the future for the Air Force in particular, for this particular study. And the depth of the study is another one of the things that are covered recently. One of the parts of the volume talked about unmanned vehicles being tied to a manned vehicle. This is in 1994 and 5. And guess what the big story's been just recently? It's been unmanned vehicles tied to a manned vehicle to increase your firepower. Prescient stuff. I mean, it goes on and on. It's not just that. It goes from the mundane refueling techniques all the way to remarkable weapons, orbital things in space that hadn't even been thought of.
And organizational things. The key organizational insight was that air power needed its own research establishment, fully set up with laboratories where scientists and engineers, both in uniform and out of uniform, could pursue their work with a good deal of freedom. And this was the main institutional selling point of Toward New Horizons, and it changed the Air Force. With the creation of Air Research and Development Command, and later replaced by Air Force Systems Command, it made it into a technological service. I'd like to make an appeal to young persons who are listening to this podcast to spend a little time and look into the life of Theodore von Karman. One thing is, you'll like him. You'll be charmed by him, as people were in his own time. That alone is worth something. But he left a memoir called The Wind and Beyond, which is very readable, very interesting. And then, say, my own biography, somewhat immodestly, The Universal Man, Theodore von Karman's Life in Aeronautics, is a biographical approach. And I think young people coming into the Air Force would be well advised to learn about this founder of the modern Air Force and have the pleasure of knowing him.
I totally agree, Mike. It is one of the things that I'm afraid that we're losing as an institution, at least when I say institution, the institutional Air Force, is that reflection on how we actually got where we are today. We live in such a soundbite-oriented iPhone, iPad world that thinking about how we got here is not always on the top of our list of things to do.
And some things can't be acquired in 3 or 4 minutes. It takes a little time and a little engagement, but I think there's great reward, not only for von Karman, but for young people to study about Hap Arnold, too. Another extraordinary person who really gave his life to the country, as so many did during World War II. A heart attack at the end of the war and never the same, and died not long after. He's a person also worth getting to know.
I'm guessing as a federal historian, a lot of what you have chronicled over the years is probably still under lock and key. Is that fair to say at the facilities where you worked?
Well, I'm glad to say no. The annual histories are, as far as I know, open through the Air Force Historical Research Center at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. I did some monographs as an Air Force historian. They should be available. I don't remember any. I don't think they were classified as I did them. And then I had a separate 13-year span with NASA, and those were all published openly by commercial publishers, whatever I wrote. So those are available as well. So I'm not sure anyone should rush out and look into them. Probably not, but they're on the shelves if somebody is crazy enough to want to look for them.
What is the name of the Dryden book, and is it out yet? How can we get it?
Well, it's a few years still awaiting launch, Dick, but it's called NASA's Forgotten Genius, Hugh L. Dryden and the Foundations of the American Space Program. It's published by Springer Publishers in New York, and I'm hoping it comes out in, 2027 is possible, but it's a few years off, and we'll have an anniversary that it will be tied to, one of NASA's big anniversaries. So I'm doing the last bit of document collection, and then I'll start writing, but this is a labor of love also. I started thinking about Dryden 30 years ago, and I'm now finally, after writing a lot of other things, being able to come back to it and fulfill it, I hope.
I would like to thank Mike for being on the program and shedding those very insightful and precise comments on von Karman. It's something that will tie this podcast series together all the way through the end of the year. And we're very lucky to have you with us today, Mike.
Well, Dick, I'm honored to be here. Not only as a token of our friendship, it's been a pleasure linking up with you again, and I was very glad to do this. It's really made my day.
So now that you know just a little bit about Dr. von Karman, find the link in the show story and then go read von Karman's pivotal report, Where We Stand. It's published in full in the great book, Architects of American Air Supremacy, General Hap Arnold and Dr. Theodore von Karman, a book written by the then major, Dick Daso. Go read it. And when you do, be sure to check back to its originally published date. I had to do it a few times to let it sink in. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Matt Jolly, reminding you to know the past, shape the future. Thank you.